Suffice it to say, Wisconsin was a very different place in the early 1800s, and we'll be talking about it with our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. My guest, Peter Schrake, he is the author of the book, The Silver Man, The Life and Times of Indian Agent John Kinsey. Peter's been an archivist with the Wisconsin Historical Society Library and Archives, executive director of Sauk Historical Museum, currently the archivist at Circus World Museum in Baraboo. You may have some questions about frontier life in Wisconsin. What about that time appeals to you? I hope you'll join in our conversation. Call in at 1-800-642-1234. You can send us an email at talk@wpr.org. Or post a question or maybe a historical photo on our Facebook page. Just search for The Larry Mueller Show. And we'd certainly love to hear from you. And Peter Schrake, welcome to the program. Thanks for taking time to be with us today. Appreciate it very much.
Well, thank you for having me.
You know, it's an interesting book, an interesting story. First, how'd you get interested in this particular history?
Well, it goes back to when I was a graduate student at University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire, and at the time, learning the new methodology of studying history, I kind of wanted to, start in a period that I had known nothing about, and that was, at the time, there were several professors up there that were very knowledgeable on Jacksonian Indian policy, and so I just started researching it, and I became fascinated by it. And it was one of those things where you saw all elements of, I think, human behavior, both good and bad, and why these things evolved the way they did. And really you saw with this subject, you see these events play out today. Any community that has a Native American presence is still grappling with the issues that began back in the 1820s and 1830s. And so that's kind of how it started many years ago. But my thesis was on a treaty and an Indian agent that it was different than Kinsey. It was a guy named Samuel Stambach who was up in Green Bay. And I became fascinated with the role of the Indian agent. And so once I finished my thesis and finished my work there, I just kept on researching. And then a number of years ago, my focus on Kinsey kind of got started when a friend of mine became the director of the Indian Agency House Museum in Portage, and she invited me to come to give a talk on John Kinsey as an Indian agent. And that led me to a series of projects of focusing on Kinsey, including an article in the Wisconsin Magazine of History, and that evolved into the book that we have today.
Yeah, and it's an interesting book for sure. And I can't remember, and I think you even mentioned, I don't recall ever reading much of anything about Indian agents.
There's not a lot out there. I mean, and I think since the 1950s, there may be about 6 or 8 books total written about them. I mean, there's been a handful of articles, but they're kind of an obscure figure in American history, and they were a critical figure in that for decades, for generations, they were a principal point of contact between really two cultures, the American culture and the Native American culture, or specifically the American government and the sovereign Indian nations. And so they were this crucial kind of position. And some agents were good, some were bad, some were inept, some were very had deep impact on the federal government and its decisions that it would make with the different tribes. And so I find that they're a very underrepresented and often overlooked historical figure.
And John Kinsey was, he did a lot of good things. He certainly has had his own flaws, like we all do. But would you set the stage for us? What was Wisconsin like at that time?
The story really takes place in the years around the War of 1812 and just afterwards. The Wisconsin is very much a frontier area. Most of the state, if not all of the state, is still owned and still, under essentially by the different tribes that live in Wisconsin, the Ojibwa to the north and the Ho-Chunk kind of to the south and west, and the Menominee and the Potawatomi are still the main communities in this area. There are only two real organized villages in Wisconsin during this time period. You have Green Bay and you have Prairie du Chien, and these are holdovers from the old fur trade and still largely kind of retain their original French characteristics. And so Chicago, where Kinsey spends most of his youth, is a tiny little community of maybe, 50 buildings? And so this is very much, the edge of the frontier. If you were in the United States Army, for example, and you were assigned one of the army posts on the frontier, Prairie du Chien, by 1816, Prairie du Chien and Green Bay and Chicago and Rock Island all had forts, you were kind of like being sent to the far side of the moon. It was an airtime, too, where communication was difficult, often depending upon rivers. Roads were there, but not really, that great a network of roads. And during the winter, especially if you were in a more remote community, you were cut off. No mail or anything often came through. So it was a different place.
Well, Kinsey was an interesting guy. Maybe talk a little bit about his background, his family, and growing up a bit.
Sure. Kinsey comes from, I like to kind of call him a product of the Great Lakes frontier. His father was born in Montreal and had started off essentially as a silversmith, who then quickly realized that there was a better living to be made in the fur trade, or what was then also often referred to as the Indian trade. So that often involved furs, but essentially a mercantile trade with the different Indian tribes. His father floated around from around kind of Fort Wayne and Detroit and Chicago and that neck of the woods for a while. And in 1803, John Harris Kinsey was born in Detroit. That's where his father was living at the time, in one of his kind of wanderings as he was having one trading post and then another trading post. And it was a time period, too, where there were multiple kind of conflicts, the various different, quote-unquote, Ohio Indian Wars, where the United States was pushing into the Ohio and Indiana, and you had a range of different conflicts going on in that area. Kinsey's father had his trading post burned more than one occasion. And so the family fortunes were always kind of ebbing and flowing. But it was in Detroit in 1803 where John Harris Kinsey was born. And not long after that, the family moved to Chicago. And that's where kind of young John Kinsey grew up. Had a rudimentary education. There's the family story that a sloop that came to visit with basically supplies and trade goods that would annually come to visit Chicago had on board, amongst different items in a chest of tea, a spelling book. And it was this simple spelling book where young John Harris Kinsey kind of learned his letters. But there was no real formal education, so to speak. But he had it from an early age, certainly a natural intellect, and a natural aptitude for picking up languages.
Yeah, he was really great at that.
Yes. I mean, by the time he was an adult, he had mastered six of them. Six Indian languages. Wrote dictionaries for two of them. And by the time he was a teenager, I think it was a Potawatomi, Ottawa, and was it Ojibwa at that point, mm-hmm. that he had already learned, by the time he was a young man. But his father continued to always kind of play a role, I think, in his career. And in the years in Chicago, John Kinsey Sr., his father, had developed a working relationship with the American Fur Company. And after the War of 1812, used his position to get his son an apprenticeship for the American Fur Company, and had him sent up to Mackinac Island, which was the center of the American Fur Company's main fur trade operations. And his son, or John Harris Kinsey, I should say, it's sometimes hard to get John Kinsey Sr. and John Kinsey Jr. often confused. But John Harris Kinsey, the subject of her book, became apprenticed to the two main leaders of the American Fur Company in the Great Lakes area, and that was Ramsey Crooks and Robert Stewart. And so that's where really, I think, you know, another big influential period in his life starts to take off, because, you know, his education is furthered there. He's under the tutelage of the kind of this demanding Scotsman, Robert Stewart. His reading is also improved under Stewart's wife. He learns all sorts of means of accounting and bookkeeping. And so his time with the American Fur Company is almost like a high school and college for him as well.
And I think it'd be interesting to talk about the various Indian tribes. There were conflicts between among the tribes, and so they had that going on. And then there was also a lot of conflict with white folks who were coming in, especially lead miners.
Yes, that is a situation that permeates really the Wisconsin frontier. In the case of the former, where you talk about kind of the conflicts between the different tribes, this relates actually to one of the great events that John Kinsey witnesses as a younger man. In 1825, there is a treaty council that is negotiated at Prairie du Chien. And unlike many other treaties of this time period, it's not a land cession treaty. The government is not trying to buy land from the tribes. It's there principally to resolve a long-standing border war or boundary dispute between the Sauk and the Dakota over just west of the Mississippi River in Iowa and in Minnesota. Those two different Indian nations had been at a long-standing war, essentially, with each other. And the federal government felt that the best way to resolve that conflict was to settle a boundary line between the two. And so they hold this huge council, the largest at that time in Prairie du Chien, and the solution is not just to settle the boundary between those two peoples, but also with many of the other tribes in the upper Mississippi River Valley. And because the Dakota and the Sauk have boundaries with these other tribes as well. And this conflict actually, and the treaty that results from this conflict, actually ends up being a far-reaching event, because it establishes, in the eyes of the federal government, the specific boundary lines of all of the tribes in the upper Mississippi River Valley. And it's from these boundaries that all of the land cessions that later would occur in the next 15 to 20 years would be derived from. And so these conflicts had long-ranging impacts, local impacts, long-ranging impacts. You also, as you say, had conflicts between the settlers and the different Indian tribes. And lead mining, exactly, that is it. You've got in 1819, lead, or the massive quantities of lead deposits, are kind of rediscovered by Americans in the upper Mississippi River Valley. And I say rediscovered because the French knew about it, the Spanish knew about it, the different native tribes knew about it. But the Americans really came to appreciate this, the fact that there was a lot of lead that could be mined in the upper Mississippi River Valley. And this is important for them because there's only one set of mining fields in Missouri at the time, and most of our lead comes from foreign sources, from especially Great Britain. And lead is used for everything, not just from bullets, but it was used to keep windows in place, line sinks. It even was thought to have medicinal capabilities. And so anybody who could mine it in great quantities could make a fortune. The problem was the vast majority of the lead fields were on Ho-Chunk territory. And as the miners were pressing into northwestern Illinois and then farther into Wisconsin, they were trespassing onto Ho-Chunk lands. They were also impacting Ho-Chunk economy, which, you know, this is a society that, you know, it's both farming and and hunting, you know, is how they live, get the things that they need to live. But in lean years for hunting and lean years for farming, crops are not good. Lead mining and then the trading of goods for that lead, you know, was a great supplemental income. And so the miners were infringing upon that economy in addition to infringing upon their territory. And so you also had a community where alcohol was a real problem, especially amongst the settlers. And so you mix all that together. You know, you have intertribal conflicts, you have settler and Indian conflicts, you've got alcohol thrown in with that, and just the fact that on the frontier, rumor rules the day. So somebody hears a story about someone being killed off in the distance, and that gets blown out of proportion. And it made Wisconsin and Illinois and Iowa and Minnesota sometimes a very violent place to live.
Talk about those conflicts and how John Kinsey fits into them with our guest today, Peter Schrake, who is the author of The Silver Man, The Life and Times of Indian Agent John Kinsey. Join in with your own questions or comments or experiences to share at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Net. Coming up at 11:45, Mad Dog and Merrill will be giving us tips on grilling your next tailgate party. Hope you can stay with us for that. Right now, having an interesting time talking with Peter Schrake, author of The Silver Man, The Life and Times of Indian Agent John Kinsey. He witnessed the changes in U.S. relations with Native tribes in the first half of the 19th century and pretty much from the War of 1812 to the forced removal of the Ho-Chunk people from their native lands. Again, join in at 800-642-1234. Well, how did John Kinsey then figure into this?
He's more than anything, really, for much of his time, he's an observer. He is, like, say, at this council in 1825 at Prairie du Chien, he's an employee of the American Fur Company. And so he's not a government agent at that point yet, but this is a huge event that has a great impact on basically his livelihood and his boss's livelihood. So he's a witness to that event. At that council, he most likely makes a reacquaintance with Lewis Cass, who's the territorial governor of Michigan, and also, consequently, the superintendent of Indian Affairs. He's the guy that basically oversees all Indian-white relations in Michigan Territory. Cass is well aware of Kinsey's languages, mastery in languages, and within a year hires him as a private secretary. So there, his involvement now with it by 1826 starts to shift to actually being a official government player. And his first job is to be sent east, just a little bit, to northwestern Ohio to study the Wyandot language and customs. Cass is always directing his Indian agents and secretaries and such to study the different Indian cultures and kind of was a collector of that. But by 1828, he appoints John Kinsey as the Indian agent at Portage for the newly created Fort Winnebago Agency. Kinsey, in the meantime, accompanies Cass as his private secretary to Indian councils. There's another significant one in 1827 at Little Lake Butamore near Oshkosh. He is present when the end of what is known as the Winnebago War, where the Ho-Chunk essentially lash out in frustration against the different miners. This kind of violent nature on the frontier that we were just talking about kind of culminates in a series of very localized attacks by the Ho-Chunk in 1827 around Prairie du Chien. That leads to a dramatic surrender by a chief by the name of Redbird at Portage in 1827. Kinsey is there. He's not directing policy. He's not affecting these events, but he's a witness to them. But it's after Redbird's surrender that the United States creates Fort Winnebago at Portage and creates a new Indian agency to kind of watch over affairs between the Ho-Chunk and the United States. And Cass selects John Kinsey as his new Indian agent. And there is where Kinsey gets more directly involved. An Indian agent is like a diplomat. That's the best way one can really describe what an agent is. It's in a modern term. And it comes back from the fact that tribes, then as now, are sovereign nations. And have, in some levels, they're like an independent state within the United States. They have a sovereignty like England or France, but they are ultimately under the authority of the United States, one could say. It's an odd relationship that we inherit from Great Britain, but in order to really maintain these relationships, the government felt that we needed to have a representative on hand for as a point of contact, and that was the Indian agent, and that's what Kinsey becomes. He becomes this governmental agent, and that's where he then gets a direct front row seat to what is going on with the Ho-Chunk and the different land sessions that result, and then kind of those early stages of removal.
Let's take some calls, several callers online with questions and comments. Kay in Wisconsin Dells, thanks for calling.
Hi. I have a question about how much of a role Juliet Kinsey played and how much you used her diary, which is so readable and interesting.
Juliet Kinsey, at the time, does not have a great direct role. She is clearly his wife. And shares his experiences for much of their time at Portage. She's not there during his first year as an agent. He is appointed in December of 1828, and then she arrives, I believe it's in 1830. And so her writings, which Wall Bun, The Early Day in the Northwest, as you point out, it not only are they a great read, they are an actual important resource. Juliet's description of the Wisconsin frontier remains an important window into this world. But really, Juliet doesn't impact John's decision-making or his activities. She is kind of another observer. She's sharing this life with him on the frontier, but she doesn't really play a role outside of that of just, what the role of a lot of women played, in the 19th century at that time. And that is essentially, this dutiful wife, so to speak. But what Juliet's importance is her education, her abilities as a writer, as an observer, and it's her descriptions of that time period. And I always kind of find it ironic. This is one of the initial questions. Her book is one of the reasons why I ended up looking at John Kinsey, is that in the time period, Juliet Kinsey would not have been that well known in the frontier. John Kinsey was the one that was well known. He was the one that knew Lewis Cass. He's the one that knew the main players of the American Fur Company. He knew personally many of the local native leaders, and so he was kind of a somebody on the frontier. Juliet was his wife. Now in transport now, 150, 175 years later, the roles are completely reversed. Because of Juliet's writings, Juliet is well known and is an important historical figure, and her husband has become this kind of side note. It has been largely forgotten. And it's through Juliet, though, that we know really the story starts, because it's through Juliet that we kind of get these other sides of John Kinsey, and the reason why we want to study him in the first place, because of her wonderful book. She also wrote a second biographical sketch of John Kinsey for the Chicago Historical Society in 1868, which together provide really the kind of solid bedrock from which we study not only the frontier but also John Kinsey's life,
A lot of his papers were lost. In probably the Chicago fire, I think you said
that yes, and that's a presumption on my part, because both Juliet and John, when they after they left Portage, they went to Chicago, and I'm 99% sure that's where they were destroyed. They had to be, because they don't survive. And in fact, actually, what's kind of frustrating is that Juliet, in her 1868 sketch, refers to the fact that John had a diary, and a lot of the interesting facts of his life are covered in this diary, and she refers to it. you know, but it's we don't have that anymore. You know?
Oh, it's really too bad.
It is, because this is a guy that, that you know, saw so many great events of this period, knew so many of these people, and we don't know really what his personal feelings are. Coming back to Juliet, though, we can get some sense of it, because Waubonne was written in 1856. John had to have at least read the manuscript and commented to Juliet on it, and so Waubonne on some level has to reflect a little bit of his thoughts on this time period as well. But so we have maybe a sampling of what his sentimentality was on some of these things that are going on. But to come back to what the caller is referring to in Juliet's role, one cannot underestimate her role in understanding this time period. And it's through her writings that we really, you know, we have this first window into this time period.
David in Decorah, Iowa, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, David. Thanks for calling.
Hi, gentlemen. Good morning. As it turns out, I'm in Prairie du Chien this morning today, so I'm local here to where you're talking.
Great place.
I guess what I'm bringing up is kind of on topic, off topic, in that it's not as regional, but Dan O'Brien, who is a wonderful writer out of the Black Hills, has written two books that I thought were relevant. One's called The Indian Agent, where he deals mostly with the agent there and Red Cloud in the settling of the reservation at that point. And the other one was called The Contract Surgeon, who was a contract cavalry surgeon who worked at the reservation and was there for the Sitting Bull, Crazy Horse drama and the death of both of those leaders for Hunk Papa and Oglala's, and they're really, really nice stories. I guess you have to call it historical fiction because he gives a dialogue.
Yeah.
But they're wonderful stories. Dan O'Brien is a wonderful writer on this kind of subject matter from Hills, and I just wanted to kind of chip that in, even though it's not quite as regional.
Thanks, David. A comment, Peter?
I will confess, Dan O'Brien's book is on my short list of readings. I haven't had a chance to read it yet. I've read a lot about it, though, and a lot of synopsis kind of about it. And what that points to, I think, is to me is that, and one of the reasons why I want to kind of look into what he's written about is that that's another era in the story of the Indian agent, kind of that post-Civil War westward expansion kind of era, where you're talking about more direct conflicts with the different tribes. What we're talking about with John Kinsey is an earlier time period and an earlier period with Indian agents, and that's more the Jacksonian Indian policy and the pre-Jacksonian Indian policy. But together, it's the what O'Brien writes about and that period, it ties into it's that next phase of federal Indian policy and that role of Indian agents, and it's I think that it just as important, just as much how much we need to understand that period and the role of Indian agents, as well as and how that ties in with, like, say, the era of Kinsey's. So I will confess I need to keep up on my reading to look at that, but it's a good book, I think.
David, thank you so much. I want to give Dennis and Coloma a chance to join in. Dennis, thank you for calling.
Hi, this is very interesting. I'm wondering if Mr. Kinsey had any dealings with the Oneida tribe near Green Bay.
Not directly. That would have been more the Indian agents up around Green Bay. And specifically people like Samuel Stambach or Henry Brevoort, who was the Indian agent in the 1820s, through much of the 1820s. The Oneida are not originally from Wisconsin, of course. They're from New York, and they're a part of this larger effort driven by land speculators in New York to kind of clear New York of Indian title to different lands so they can buy that land cheaply and then kind of turn around and sell it at a profit. And all of that swirls around a treaty in 1821 where the Oneida and six other Indian nations from New York enter into an agreement with the Menominee to buy lands and to ultimately to emigrate to Wisconsin. That's a whole other story. Ironically or incidentally, was actually one of the main sources or focuses of my master's thesis. The Menominee end up kind of feeling tricked as a result of this original deal in 1821, where they cede most of their lands to the Oneida and the Stockbridge and Muncie and St. Regis and Tuscarora tribes, and kind of cry foul right away, and a 10-year dispute erupts that ultimately is solved, so to speak, in a treaty in 1831 that is kind of hammered through by Samuel Stambach. Now, the connection to Kinsey really is more through Stambach. Kinsey, as far as I know, never had any real anything to do with the Oneida or with the boundary dispute. He would have been present at some of the different treaty councils where they tried to resolve it, like this council at Butamore in 1827. But that was really kind of outside of his jurisdiction. That didn't really involve his agency. And when the problem first emerged in 1821, he was still a clerk up at Mackinac Island. But Stambach, who kind of forces through the first draft or first attempt at resolving this treaty, actually has a hand in possibly Kinsey resigning as Indian agent. And so there is a kind of an indirect connection between
them,
Kinsey and that. But that's a whole other very fascinating story, if you ask me.
The title of your book is The Silver Man, The Life and Times of Indian Agent John Kinsey. And I want to go back to the Silver Man because explain why he was called the Silver Man.
The name originated with his father. There's some speculation that it comes from his father's work as a silversmith. But the name clearly was passed on to John Harris Kinsey as well. And it really is mainly believed to be surrounding the fact that as Indian agents, one of their jobs was to give out or make the annuity payments to the different tribes. Whenever the government would have a treaty with the tribes, especially land cession treaties, land was purchased effectively on a payment plan by the federal government, so annual installments for this land. Those payments were made in silver coin. And so the agent would come, and there would be the annuity payment process. And because the payment was made in silver, his father first was nicknamed the Silver Man, and then when John Kinsey became Indian agent, the nickname was passed down to him. It's actually not a Ho-Chunk term, I believe. It's originated with the Potawatomi from the Chicago area. And I think it's Shawinalki, I think, is the Indian pronunciation for that term. But it's relating to the annuity payments of silver coin,
which was a difficult process to say the least, very carefully distribute the money to the various peoples.
Yes, it often got the agent into trouble, especially with the local white businessmen, whether they be fur traders or otherwise other settlers, because often the different members of the tribe were conducted the fur trade or other business on credit, and then when the annuity payments came around, these creditors, these businessmen, would come up and say, well, as a part of this payment, this particular warrior or this particular chief, owes me a certain amount of money, and so a part of this annuity payment belongs to me. And it was the Indian agent that had to go in and figure out, well, is this claim legit? Is this claim bogus? What is the actual money owed? And
Kinsey was pretty good at that.
He was. And a number of the agents were. I think sometimes Indian agents get a bum rap for either being corrupt actually probably more accurately incompetent. But many of them took these responsibilities pretty seriously, and especially with annuity payments, you had to. This is a time period in American history where Andrew Jackson pays off the national debt, and he does so by an almost manic frugality And woe to the federal officer, military or otherwise, that misappropriated federal funds. Not to say it didn't happen, but there was strict accounting. And so if you didn't do the job right, you could get into some serious trouble. But from on the federal end, but on the other hand, with the local businessman, he was basically saying that, well, your claim is wrong. You're not going to get any money, and that would lead to hard feelings. A classic case in point was a guy named William S. Hamilton, who was Alexander Hamilton's son. It got into essentially a conflict over, in some cases, over the fact that Hamilton felt that he was not properly paid for damages done to him by another chief in the Ho-Chunk. And Kinsey challenged it and said, no, your claim is not just. And so Hamilton is writing a series of letters complaining about Kinsey to people in Washington, D.C. And so, you can get into some serious disagreements with your neighbors, over these claims, and it did happen.
And one other thing, he was in charge of inoculations for smallpox.
Yes, and that had to be a grisly affair. The process is essentially you're taking kind of this white ooze that emulates from the smallpox pustules. And you're kind of baking them in the sun and letting them die, but then you're inserting that physically under the skin, and then an infection would follow. And then if you presuming you survive the infection, you are vaccinated against the smallpox. And the Kinsey had to do that because the surgeon at Fort Winnebago refused to be involved in the process, in part due because the procedures cost more than what he was allocated money for to do. And so to do so, he would have had to have paid money out of his own pocket to buy the necessary supplies. And so Kinsey gets the supplies, inoculates with the aid of one of his interpreters, a guy named Pierre Paquet, some 600 Ho-Chunk at his agency. And that in itself is a controversial story as well, the whole year vaccination. The federal government, I think, allocates $12,000 for the entire project nationwide, and it's something that was generated to help facilitate the removal process. Jackson wants to eliminate Indian title to all lands east of the Mississippi River and to move these tribes west of the Mississippi River. Well, it's to make that possible, if you are out west, or out east, if you are a tribe that's suffering smallpox, you don't want to be a tribe moving into a smallpox infested area, or if you are out west, you don't want smallpox infested people to come out to you. And so it was a part of this broader Indian policy, and it was a part of the messiness of the time period. But Kinsey did it, and part of that job where agents did a little bit of everything.
Well, this we've only touched on the book itself and on the life of John Kinsey. And Peter, I thank you so much. I hope a lot of people get to read your book, and I really appreciate you taking time to be with us today.
Thank you. The pleasure was mine.
Peter Schrayk, our guest, the author of the book The Silver Man, The Life and Times of Indian Agent John Kinsey. It really gives a nice look at what was going on at that time period, and then how John Kinsey figured into it. It's a really fascinating read for me, and I think it will be for you as well. It's published by Wisconsin Historical Society Press. Coming back, we'll take a look at grilling and talk with Mad Dog and Merrill.